So, yeah, first of all, I'd just like to thank Carol and her team at the Freud Museum. It's a real pleasure to speak here, where Freud lived, as Carol mentioned. Between 1895 and 1898, Freud journeyed to Italy 5 times without ever reaching Rome. At the same time, the longing to visit the city grew and grew. In a letter to his friend Wilhelm Fliess, Freud described his longing for Rome as deeply neurotic. Indeed, Rome literally became the city of his dreams. In The Interpretation of Dreams, first published at the end of 1899, Freud analysed a series of his dreams based, as he put it, on his yearning to visit the city. And he explained the dream in the following terms. I had, in fact, been travelling in the footsteps of Hannibal. Like me, he had never been granted the privilege of seeing Rome. Hannibal, with whom I had now had this in common, had been a hero in my school days. Like so many at that age, I had bestowed my sympathies during the Punic Wars not on the Romans, but on the Carthaginians. And when in my later schoolboy years, some understanding began to dawn on me of the consequences of being descended from a foreign race, and anti-Semitic stirrings among my friends urged me to take a stand, the figure of the Semitic general rose even further in my estimation. In the eyes of the youth that I was, Hannibal and Rome symbolized the contrast between the toughness of Jewry and the organization of the Catholic Church. And Freud went on. The desire to visit Rome came in the dream to cloak and symbolize a number of other much longed-for desires, towards the realization of which one would like to work, with the endurance and single-mindedness of the Carthaginian Hannibal, and the fulfillment of which seems sometimes as little favoured by fate as Hannibal's lifelong wish to enter Rome. Freud's portrayal of Hannibal as a member of the so-called Semitic race reflected a 19th-century intellectual context in which scholars of the ancient world made a sharp distinction between Indo-European or Aryan languages and cultures on the one hand and Semitic languages and cultures on the other. Hannibal's origins in Carthage in North Africa put him firmly in the latter camp, in the 19th century scholarly imagination at least. Freud's identification with Hannibal was an explicit comment on the anti-Semitism he experienced as a schoolboy and the increasing phobic paranoia Jews would have suffered in Fantasiecle Vienna. Hannibal, the Semitic Carthaginian against ancient Rome, became Freud, the modern Jew, against the Roman Catholic Church. A dream for Freud was the fulfillment of an unconscious wish. His desire to be like Hannibal, then, was his desire to revivify the courage and perseverance of the ancient general. But the dream also led Freud to recall an incident in his young life, a conversation with his father. Straight after the passage I've just quoted, Freud continues. And it's at this point that I stumble across the childhood experience that to this day continues in all these feelings and dreams to wield its power. I was perhaps 10 or 12 years old when my father started taking me with him on his walks and sharing with me in our conversations his thoughts on things of this world. Once, for example, to show me how much more favourable were the times I'd been born into than those he had, he told me this story. He said, One Saturday, when I was young, I was walking along the street in the town where you were born, dressed in my best clothes, wearing a new fur cap. A Christian comes past, swipes my cap off, sending it into the mud, and says, down off the pavement, Jew boy. And what did you ask? I, Freud, replied. Stepped into the roadway and recovered my cap, was his calm reply. That struck me as unheroic on the part of the big strong man holding little me by the hand. I compared this situation, which I found unsatisfactory, with another that suited my feelings better, namely the scene in which Hannibal's father, Hamilcar Barker, has his boy swear before the house altar that he will wreak revenge upon the Romans. Hannibal has had a place in my fantasies ever since. Freud's dreams of being Hannibal, then, take us back to a painful, even shameful childhood memory when Freud first saw his father as a victim of anti-Semitic feeling. Right at the end of the 19th century, Freud, a secular Jew, saw himself in a battle against Rome, which represented the oppressions of the Catholic Church. His identification with Hannibal, however, didn't just set Freud into a neurotic antipathy against Rome. It also aligned him with ancient Greece. That's to say, Freud clearly set himself into something like an Oedipal relationship with his Jewish father. Whilst the fantasy is not explicitly a parricidal one, Freud sought to do what his father didn't and stand up to the anti-Semite. Freud was intent on outdoing his father, making right the failings he perceived in the father figure. Freud's identification with Hannibal, then, was Oedipal insofar as Freud sought to replace the father, just as Oedipus had replaced his own father on the throne at Thebes in the ancient Greek myth. And whilst Freud doesn't mention Oedipus at this point in the interpretation of dreams, I'm pretty sure that the myth was in his thoughts. For the interpretation of dreams was the very book in which Freud put into print his theory of the Oedipus complex for the first time. It was in this book that Freud argued that in our unconscious we're all like Oedipus, that as small children we live through a psychodrama of our own making in which we yearn for our mother who first gave us the breast and feel a murderous hatred for our father who threateningly competes for attention with our maternal object of desire. It's our inability to successfully work through the Oedipus complex which Freud will cite as the cause of our psychological problems. And in many ways, none of us stops missing the mother's breast, that original object of desire. Our adult partners are merely substitutes for that object, Freud famously argued. And according to Freud, it's in our dreams, these nocturnal wish fulfillments, where we can relive those incestuous desires and paradisal tendencies. Freud's turn to Oedipus to explain all of our minds might today seem like rather an ambitious generalisation. But his turn to Greek myth reflected a wider 19th century reception of classical Greek culture, where most middle-class Western European boys and some girls were schooled in ancient Greek and taught to worship its literature. And Freud was no exception. In this lecture this evening, I'd like to talk to you about how Greek myth seemed to Freud to explain so much about human psychology. And as we'll see, it was precisely Freud's turning away from Rome which was crucial for his turning to ancient Greece. Freud's identification with Hannibal in 1899 reflected Freud's intervention in a much bigger debate about sexual pathology at the end of the 19th century. Before the emergence of Freud and the invention of psychoanalysis, medical accounts of sexuality were populated by psychiatrists practicing a science called sexology. Sexology involved the classification or the taxonomization of sexual perversions. The practitioners of the discipline discussed whether sexual pathologies were inherited or environmentally induced, and they investigated how subjects could be cured of these so-called perversions, and whether it was just that their patients should be subjected to the strong arm of the law. One of the most famous was Freud's fellow Austrian, the professor of psychiatry at the University of Vienna, Richard von Krafft-Ebing. And my lecture tonight hinges on the publication in 1886 of a very important book by this man called Psychopathia Sexualis, a Clinical Forensic Study. Krafft-Ebing's book was a work of forensic reference for other psychiatrists, doctors, and legal professionals, in which he assembled numerous case studies of sexual pathology. And it was a marked success. It had gone through numerous editions and translations by the beginning of the 20th century and became one of the most widely read and quoted texts of sexology. Its significance was such that it mapped out many of the categories of sexual identity with which we still live today. So Krafft-Ebing standardized and popularized such terms as homosexual, fetish, sadist, and masochist, for instance. And whilst the Latin of the title advertised the learned nature of the book, much of the content of the book itself was also in Latin. As Krafft-Ebing wrote in his preface, "In order that unqualified persons should not become readers, I saw myself compelled to choose a title understood only by the learned, and also, where possible, to express myself in terminis technicis, or technical terms. Now, it seems that Krafft Ebing was simply using classical Latin to bolster and lend authority to the language of sexology. Of course, Latin had been the language of scientific taxonomy for some time. Linnaeus's classificatory system is the most famous example. But whilst we take it for granted that Latin was such a language of authority in the West until at least the end of the 19th century, what's rarely unpacked is how this actually occurred. So this talk then provides the outlines of a longer history of how Latin came to provide these technical terms for sex in Krafft Ebing's sexology. In attending to his Latin more closely than other historians of sexuality usually do, we will see, however, that Latin was no straightforward language of authority. By thinking a little more carefully about the Latinity of modern scientific discourse, I'd like to draw attention to the literary discourses out of which 19th century sexology emerged. Or simply put, it matters to know where the language of a science comes from. So my questions for tonight are, precisely how did Latin come to provide these technical terms for sex in Krafft Ebing's magisterial tome? And what role did the sexual vocabulary of ancient Rome play in the development of 19th century sexology? And finally, what impact did this all have on Sigmund Freud? In order to answer these questions, we have to turn back to the beginning of our story some 2,000 years ago to ancient Rome itself, to read a pretty notorious poem, which I doubt appears on many O-level or GCSE syllabuses, but some of you who are more curious readers might have read this when your Latin teacher wasn't looking. This is poem number 16 in a book of poems by a man called Catullus. I will fuck your ass, and I will fuck your mouth, Aurelius, you arsehole, and Furious, you fairy. You who think because my verses are a little soft that I have no shame. For it's proper to be a pious poet to be chaste himself, but it's not at all necessary for his little verses to be. In this poem, Catullus threatens to rape two readers who call him effeminate or soft for writing poetry about love. Now, the first thing to notice here is the remarkable specificity of the offences voiced here by Catullus. Classical Latin was equipped with a very rich sexual vocabulary, so that the Roman poet wasn't just limited to saying fuck you to someone he didn't like, but he could tell that person exactly where he would like to fuck them. This reflects a highly developed vocabulary of sexual obscenity in ancient Rome, which is set out for you in this lovely table. So all six of these words in Latin are obscene words, meaning we would translate them to fuck. So there are at least six words for this in Latin. And each word depends on precisely where the penis goes, okay? So the words on the left-hand side of the column refer to, you know, actively inserting the penis into the vagina, the anus, or the mouth. And on the right-hand side of the column, those words mean to be fucked in the vagina, the anus, and the mouth, okay? Catullus then threatens to rape these readers in the arse and the mouth if they can't see that his words do not reflect his real-life actions. His threat reveals his desire for control over their mouths, to control over what they're saying about him. His anal and oral insertion demonstrates his desire for authority over language, the authority to say whatever he wants in his poetry. Catullus's poem reveals a very Roman concern about the impenetrability of the body of the free-born adult male Roman citizen. To participate in a sexual act for a Roman man was to assert his authority, position, and status in society. The Roman man penetrated but was not to be penetrated. That's the meaning behind the aspersion about Catullus's softness in the poem. The activeness of the Roman man was to be contrasted with the sexual passivity of women, slaves, and boys. Having sex, then, was simply one of a range of strategies by which free Roman men demonstrated and performed their power on a social stage. At the same time, however, Catullus's poetic voice was also self-ironizing and self-questioning, as the claim to authority over the language he uses is undercut. So, that's to say, if the poet is actually virtuous and chaste, he will never carry out the rape. But if he carries out the rape in the poem, he substantiates those claims against his morals. So there's a paradox in the poem. And we, the readers, are left wondering how ironically knowing we're to imagine Catullus was in using this language. How confidently assertive was he? How cleverly self-mocking was he being? Or how transparently insecure is Catullus to seem here? With how much authority does Catullus use those obscene Latin words? The difficulty of knowing how to use the Roman vocabulary of sex became a subject of hot debate much later during the Italian Renaissance. In the 1420s, a young aspiring poet from Palermo in Sicily, Antonio Beccadelli, wrote two books of obscene epigram called The Hermaphrodite. They were designed to show off his wit and intellect to attract the patronage of no less a patron than Cosimo de' Medici. Beccadelli knew he was taking a risk in not trotting out a panegyric or another epic poem. Indeed, his poems in The Hermaphrodite focus on the difficulties of writing and reading epigrams. And in one he writes the following. I'm on fire, my dear Galeazzo, a friend of his. I'm on fire to find wanton Catullus, so I can gratify my mistress. The lusty lass loves to read the tender poets, and she prefers your verses, learned Catullus. And just now she sweetly asked me for them, with many a prayer, thinking that her favourite poet was perhaps in my house. Beccadelli presents himself as having to compete with Catullus for his girlfriend's attention, who prefers to read the Romans' poetry. If Beccadelli could just get hold of Catullus's text, then he might too have some luck with his girlfriend. And Beccadelli's desire for the Catullan text, in order to have sex with his girlfriend, anticipates slightly later Renaissance debates about the representation of sex in Catullus's poetry. So, famously in 1489, the famous Florentine classical scholar Angelo Poliziano argued very famously that a poem in which Catullus offers his beloved lesbia a sparrow as a gift, that this sparrow was merely a metaphor for the poet's penis. Whilst Catullus's poems about lesbia now almost always find themselves on school and university Latin syllabuses, back in the 15th century, these short poems exercised the finest Renaissance minds. Only one manuscript of Catullus had survived into the Renaissance period from antiquity, making the text hard to get hold of, literally. Furthermore, the text itself was notoriously corrupt. Meters were confused, poems were run together, and often the point of the poem itself was lost. Simply put, Catullus was very difficult to read. And the relationship between Catullus's sexuality and the words he used epitomised this debate. This poem here, about Beccadelli's efforts to get hold of Catullus's poem, reflected the difficulty people had in getting a grip on Catullus's meaning, on how are we to read representations of desire and sexuality in his poetry. Catullus's short poems were compared by his Renaissance readers to Martial's epics, another Roman writer of poetry, short poems. Martial's epigrams were already more widely circulated and read during the 14th and 15th centuries. But epigrammatic poetry was characteristically slight, ephemeral, and fragile. They're short poems. The Roman poet Martial had himself often worried about the possible loss of his poetry, and he complained in ancient Rome about the plagiarism of his verses. He was concerned that a poem could belong to anyone who recites it, or he hears how other poets are pretending that they are vomiting snake venom under his name. Martial's poems were desirable commodities, but also vulnerable entities. Just as Beccadelli sought the manuscript of Catullus, as we've just seen, in another poem, Beccadelli begged a friend for his extremely scarce copy of Martial. The word epigram originally meant monument, but with Martial and Catullus, it became a gossipy fragment just as much as a memorial of remembrance. The point of the fragile epigram, then, was always hard to grasp. It delighted in paradox and oxymoron. Beccadelli used Catullus 16, the poem we began with, to defend the obscenity of his hermaphrodite. As long as one lived without reproach, he argued in his prelude, one could write as one liked. And yet Beccadelli knew he was playing a very difficult game in writing obscene poetry, which was meant to show off his intellect and wit. The idea that there was a correct and authoritative way of reading the sexual and obscene Latin was an issue he actually addressed in several of the poems, especially the poems that feature a certain character called Mattia Lupi, probably fictional, who was a pederastic schoolteacher who would have affairs with his male pupils. And as Beccadelli suggests, that very figure who was supposed to teach his pupils to read Latin was also the figure who was having the most sex. So this two-line epigram, Mattia Lupi has three students in his private school, in his Aula Arcana, and one of the three is his houseboy. So the innuendo to be inferred here is that the houseboy is a young male servant who's paying for his lessons with his sexual labours. And the phrase for private school, Aula Arcana, looks back to the use of this phrase in a Roman epic poem by a guy called Statius, an epic poem about the Greek hero Achilles. And this phrase comes up in that epic poem when on the island of Scyros, Ulysses, the Greek hero, comes looking through the Aula Arcana, or the secret chambers of the maidens, in search of Achilles, a boy who was dressed up as a girl. Achilles didn't want to go off to fight in the Trojan War. So just as Mattia, the teacher, confuses learning the classics with sex, so Beccadelli's own poem makes a joke about the sexualization of the Latin language. You would only get this joke, you would only get this double meaning going on with about Statius, if you yourself knew what aula meant in classical Latin in Statius. Or rather, you'd only get the joke if you'd learned Latin yourself, suggesting that you too might have been taught by a Mattia Lupi, thereby implicating you, the reader, in the joke. Beccadelli confronts his reader with the awkward question of whether they should be appalled by his text or amused by its cleverness. What it means to know Latin and have a command over the language is at stake here. Just as Statius got his readers thinking about the relationship between the girlish boy Achilles, who would one day become the hero of the Homeric epic The Iliad, so Beccadelli wonders how the pederastic schoolroom might make the Renaissance man. Beccadelli's book, unsurprisingly, received a highly polarized reception, and this reflected the contests over who had authority to decide how to read Beccadelli's obscene Latin. Bernardino da Siena, a well-known Franciscan preacher, staged public burnings of the work in Milan, Bologna, and Ferrara. Beccadelli was burnt, an image of Beccadelli was burned twice in effigy. One humanist said that he was merely a pimp for boys, and even the Pope, Eugenius IV, apparently threatened any reader of the Hermaphrodite with excommunication. The anecdote about Cardinal Cesarini is also worth remembering. One day, the Cardinal found his secretary reading it. The priest tried to hide it, but the Cardinal confronted him, making him destroy it. But he also remarked, "If you'd known how to respond, perhaps you wouldn't have had to tear it up. What you should have answered me was that you were searching for a precious stone in a pile of dung." The Cardinal's witticism shows how it was not clear to Italian humanists how one was to respond to ancient Latinate representations of sex and desire. Indeed, it wasn't until 1559, over 100 years later, that an index of forbidden books was established by Pope Paul IV. Poggio Bracciolini, a famous humanist in Florence, defended Beccadelli, reiterating the Catullan defence that his poetry is not the same as the man himself. Others circulated their own poems that were highly critical, but they couldn't help, it seems, but use Beccadelli's own language to censor him. A certain Porcellio Pandoni disseminated verses advertising his own works, which was also a publicity campaign that aimed to ostracize Beccadelli from the arena of respectable Latinity. So Pandoni's book began with this poem, "Hasten hither, noble boys and chaste girls. This is no page marked by a Sicilian hand," so Beccadelli comes from Sicily. "There is no prick. Ursa does not lie on top of Priapus, no one but fucks. Alder does not wiggle her flanks, and there is no arsehole, no member gets erect here. You may read these poems, Cosimo, de Medici, these poems are suitable for you. The repeated negatives, then, and the emphasis on absence obviously and very clearly mark up the presence of sexual obscenity. And we're challenged to distinguish them between authoritative censoriousness and manipulating irony. How knowing are we to imagine Porcellio to have been? When could the language of sex be used in Latin so that it was suitable for Cosimo de' Medici, the very patron that Beccadilli was also courting when writing The Hermaphrodite? Catullus's poem had wittily questioned how the Roman conceptualization or that structure of sex as masculine power conferred authority on the Roman poetic voice. If the state of the manuscript of Catullus made him literally difficult to understand, then his poetry was itself already thinking back in ancient Rome about the complexities, the ironies of how it was to be read and received. And Beccadilli's own voice emerged at a turbulent time in Renaissance humanism, as it provoked his humanist readers to think hard about the proprieties of reading and writing about sex in Latin. Now, within a few years, the controversy had blown over, and Beccadilli did eventually find himself a patron, and he became a court poet in Naples. And it wasn't for another over 400 years until the 1790s when a selection of epigrams from the Hermaphrodite again saw the light of day. Precisely at a time when strange and remarkable phallic artifacts were being discovered at Pompeii and Herculaneum, attracting huge curiosity. This is a book from an antiquarian. This is a print from an 18th century antiquarian book recording discoveries found in Pompeii and Herculaneum. The emergence of these sites provoked a profound rethinking about the everyday life of the ancients, including their sexual behaviours. And a few years later, a certain librarian at the court library in Bavaria called Friedrich Karl Vorberg apparently discovered a full manuscript of Beccadilli's book and published an edition of it in 1824. The early 19th century witnessed the growing institutionalisation and professionalisation of academic disciplines in the German university system. Classical studies was at the heart of these developments, as protocols of textual criticism, notions about how to write history, what is anachronism, ideals of scholarly objectivity, all these ideas started to dominate the language of academia. The history of ancient sexual practices offered an especial challenge to those self-consciously modern 19th century scholars invested in the secular modern 19th century professionalism of their work. Forberg's edition of Beccadilli, appended to which was a long essay written in Latin about ancient sexual behaviour, was a product precisely of this intellectual environment. And Forberg divided the essay. There's a picture of the front cover there. He divided the essay into 8 sections. Sections which basically comprise anthologies of quotations from this history of obscene and erotic ancient and Renaissance Latin epigram. And you can see there that he uses these Latin words for fucking to organise the structure of his essay. Okay? Forberg begins each section with what he calls a proper or correct definition in Latin about these terms. So his essay is in Latin, about Latin. And penetration, being penetrated, then, this is a Roman idea, become the defining axes of sexual experience in his essay, as excerpts from ancient and early modern texts are collated under these headings. Latin had, of course, as I'd mentioned, been used in the 18th century as a language of taxonomy, and Forberg could not have conceived his project without figures like Carl Linnaeus, whose Latinate publications on botany and plant sexual life had classified the plants. Forberg's organisation of ancient sexual behaviour also reflected an attempt to show that there was an underlying logical structure to sexual experience. Whilst Catullus's and Martial's obscene language had provoked fiery debate during the Renaissance about how such language might be used with authority, in Forberg's book, written within the context when classical scholarship was gaining more professionalised respect, these terms of abuse and mockery were used to demonstrate how sexual practice could be shown to possess a timeless ahistorical structure. But Forberg was very aware that he was unable to control the reception of his Latin text. He called his essay the Apophoreta, and that means party gifts. And it's a quote from Marshall's last book of epigrams, which is a series of short poems he wrote as gifts to his friend, obscene, jokey poems that he wrote as gifts for his friends. And Forberg knew that his work might not just be read by serious-minded scholars. In fact, he closes his apophorate, his party gift essay, with an epigram of his own. And here it is. He says, "That is the first and the second course, wise reader. For the first course is Beccatelli's poems. The second course is his essay about the ancient sexual behaviour." He says, and then he says to his reader, "Although you're silent, I think I see what you want. You want to see them in action. The Ecosymechanon provides just that. You can get it at the bookstore. Modest Virgin, take flight." So the second line of this little poem is taken from the opening epigram of Book 2 of The Hermaphrodite by Beccadelli. And in that poem, Beccadelli had jokingly addressed Cosimo, whose lack of reply or silence to the first volume is interpreted by Beccadelli as meaning that Cosimo doesn't want to hear any more obscenity, but, as Beccadelli puts it, strenuous wars in mighty metre, or he'd rather hear an epic poem. But Beccadelli will, of course, not comply with this wish, and continue to write his lewd poetry, i.e. Book 2. Forberg's epigram then takes up this joke and advertises a companion volume to his essay. And this companion volume contains 20 plates illustrating some of the contents of his essay. And that's the meaning of the word ekosimechanon, which means basically 20 ways to do it. Forberg's bookstore, as he mentions it in the last line, also looks back to an epigram by Marshall, a poem in which a certain guy called Quintus asks Marshall to give him a free copy of his book, because he, Quintus, has no desire to spend money on Marshall's trivial poetry at the bookstore, the Bibliopola in Latin. So Forberg addresses himself to a wide and learned male readership, whilst at the same time wittily alluding to Marshall and Beccadelli and suggesting that his book might not be worth the money either. It's just smut as well. The epigram closes with another quote from Beccadelli, "Modest Virgin, take flight," where the Renaissance writer in an opening poem in The Hermaphrodite had advised a modest virgin to stay away from reading his lines. And this little quote also looks back to another poem by Marshall, in which the Roman poet catches a chaste lady enjoying his obscene lines about which he'd warned her. And then that poem goes on to say that I'll let you read my poetry anyway. So whilst Forberg, that was quite a sort of technical reading, but whilst, so to sum up, so whilst Forberg positioned himself at the cutting edge of 19th century professionalised scholarship, he also clearly displayed a satirical self-awareness about his scholarly authority. So whilst he knew that his work might not just have been read by other classical scholars, chaste ladies might be titillated by it as well, he seems not to have predicted that one of his most careful readers, on the other hand, was a man called Julius Rosenbaum. Julius Rosenbaum was a very interesting man, a medical professor and doctor at the University of Halle in Germany. Forberg's Latin definitions of ancient sexual practice were integrated in this 1839 book he wrote, in English, The Plague of Lust in Antiquity. In this work, Rosenbaum sought to locate the origins of modern venereal disease back in the ancient world. Now, Rosenbaum was writing at a time when 19th century doctors were becoming extremely concerned about the sexual health of the industrialized European city. Whilst Forberg had tried to produce an objective work of scholarship for other educated men, but had also shown a satirical awareness of how the obscene Latin could trickle into other people's hands, chaste ladies, for Rosenbaum, on the other hand, the ancient world had literally infected the modern. It was not simply the case that the classics might have a malign influence on the morals of 19th century readers. Rather, Rosenbaum was concerned to prove that the ancient world had a literal physical impact on modernity. Rather, he contended that the ancient misuse of genitals that he found and went through lots of Latin and Greek texts, the ancient misuse of genitals created the environment for the development of venereal disease itself, which we have inherited. So the authority of the obscene and abusive Latin poet is replaced by the authority of the medical doctor. In its new context, the Latin of Roman Renaissance epigram, via Forberg, which Rosenbaum constantly quotes, becomes part of a new medical vocabulary of sex in the middle of the 19th century. Indeed, classical Latin itself becomes a diagnostic tool for the modern pathologist. So lots of poems by Martial and Attalus are quoted to show examples of people suffering sores in all sorts of places, for instance. Okay, so Martial likes to comment upon, you know, that quite a lot in his poetry. So Attalus and Martial had used their epigrammatic voice as an authoritative gesture over their addressees, which triggered off a debate about such language during the Renaissance. Whereas Forberg's Latin had sought to clarify the sexual practices in Martial's text for the classical scholar, now with Rosenbaum, Martial's poetry was reframed to become medical textbook Latin. So a different figure of authority then. The Plague of Lust was the first in an unfinished trilogy on historical pathology, in which Rosenbaum sought to trace out the progress of venereal disease from ancient to modern times. While this might now seem like a strange enterprise, it was a key work in the bibliography of Richard von Krafft Ebing's Psychopathia Sexualis, this big text I began with. Indeed, alongside other sexological and criminological publications, Krafft Ebing's bibliography only lists Rosenbaum's Plague of Lust and two other 19th century German works of classical scholarship on Imperial Rome. The classical scholarship provided the vocabulary for Krafft Ebing's history of civilization more broadly. These two other works on ancient Rome are Ludwig Friedländer's Moral History of Rome, first published in 1862, and Friedrich Wiedermeister's The Madness of Caesars, first published in 1875. Both these works examined how the height of Roman luxury and decadence were also signs of the degeneration of Roman society, thereby providing Krafft Ebing with a detailed historical mirror for his own time at the end of the 19th century, and I'll come back to that more in a second. So Wiedermeister's interest in the insanity or the madness of the Caesars supplied Krafft Ebing with the possibility of linking Roman histories with theories of heredity or inheritance and degeneration. So Wiedermeister argued that the key to the madness of the Julio-Claudians, the first royal dynasty of the Roman emperors, lay in their family history. So he wrote a tale of what he called Familien Degeneration, or family degeneration. Okay, and this offered a really potent image for the family trees that Krafft Ebing constructed of his patients. So, the notion of the past then was central to Krafft Ebing's understanding of sexual perversion, in that he heavily stressed the role of inheritance or heredity in mental and sexual pathology. You got it from your grandmother or your great aunt or whatever. Krafft Ebing claimed that he had studied the family trees of numerous patients to support his argument that sexual perversion was inborn and inherited. Rosenbaum had himself contended that venereal disease in the present could be traced back to irregular, immoral sexual practices in the ancient world, as I've just mentioned. Krafft Ebing's book also understood modern sexuality in relation to antiquity, but in a somewhat different way. Krafft Ebing was writing at what we call the fin de siècle, or at the end of the 19th century, a time marked in European culture and thinking by both great optimism and great pessimism. Many commentators and intellectuals at the time argue that the rapid development of modern civilization through history had brought with it a nervous tension leading to perverse sexual habits. As Krafft Ebing famously put it in his preface, exaggerated tension of the nervous system stimulates sensuality, leads the individual as well as the masses to excess. Greece, the Roman Empire, and France under Louis XIV and XV are striking examples of this assertion. Large cities are hotbeds in which neuroses and low morality are bred. See the history of Babylon, Nineveh, and Rome, and the mysteries of modern metropolitan life. Krafft Ebing's present day, then, seemed very ancient and very modern, like Imperial Rome. His case studies of sexual perversion are populated by grandmother Messalinas, as Krafft Ebing calls them. He writes of sexual sadists who eat their partners after reading the Roman biographer Suetonius, and there are men who whip buttocks inspired by research into Roman slavery. Indeed, the Latin language itself frequently crept into Krafft Ebing's case studies. And in particular, it was Forberg's Latin, which Rose and Brown provided Krafft Ebing, who then utilised it to bolster the authority of his writing, precisely at a time when psychiatry was breaking out of the confines of the asylum, enhancing the social prestige of the discipline. Krafft Ebing used Latin to emphasise his medical authority over his patients, over the populace at large, precisely at the time when fantasy eclair hierarchies of order and authority seemed to have gone awry. Roman texts which depicted the passivity of men and the active rapaciousness of women, as well as the sexual sadism of the emperors, often offered resonant images to Krafft Ebing, whose case studies painted a deeply problematic modern world populated by sadists, masochists, and sexual criminals. Nevertheless, the tone of Krafft Ebing's so-called technical Latin is itself quite difficult to read. Interestingly, Krafft Ebing uses obscene Latin words alongside neutral terms and euphemisms which come from Forberg's definitions. The vocabulary of Roman and Renaissance epigram and the definitions of Forberg and Rosenbaum then become jumbled up, so that when we read Krafft Ebing's Latin, it becomes very difficult to judge its register. And the following example comes from a well-known case study of a man who is classified as what was called in the 19th century an Urning. An Urning is a person who had a woman's soul but was trapped inside a man's body. So it was a man who was sexually attracted to other men. And in the case study, he gives this confession about his sexual fantasies to Krafft Ebing. Okay? At the same time, I have a very lively fancy. I spend most of my leisure hours thinking of handsome men with strong limbs. I would be delighted to look on when a powerful fellow, using force, magna mentula praeditis, puellam futua, mihi persuasum est, and so on. So once the confession becomes obscene, he goes into Latin. And so it's translated underneath for you. I'd be delighted to look on when a powerful fellow, using force, endowed with a large cock, might fuck a girl. I was convinced that with this sight, my senses would be affected by the most violent passion, and while he fucks, I will touch the body of the beautiful adolescent, the boy, and if allowed, I would mount him while he is lying with the girl, and do the same to him, and insert my member into his anus. Now, the fantasy represented here is typical of what appears in the Psychopathia Sexualis, in that one sexual partner is aroused at the possibility that another is being treated violently. Krafft Ebing's case studies repeatedly present their sexual practitioners in terms of active or passive, reflecting Krafft Ebing's use of Roman sexual terminology and his theories about sadistic and masochistic pleasures being the most fundamental forms of sexual perversion. Krafft Ebing reverts into Latin, as I've said then, when the subject starts using sexually explicit language, so mentula and futuat, okay? So they're underlined for you there. But then closes the section with membrum meum in eos anum imitam, insert my member. The Latin segment contains what sounds like the subject's most sexually explicit confession, so he's fantasizing witnessing a rape and then participating in it, but then he ends with a circumlocution, okay, which comes straight out of the medical and scholarly Latin of the middle of the 19th century. So Forberg had used this verb imitam, insert, to describe what the penis does. So did the original words of Krafft Ebing's correspondent also shift in register? Is that what Krafft Ebing meant to suggest? We'll never know. If Krafft Ebing's Latin can look both like an obscene and scientific technical language, then this reflected the fact that Psychopathia Sexualis became one of the most public statements of a discourse that blurred the boundaries between the healthy and the pathological at the end of the 19th century. Krafft Ebing's book was filled with numerous case studies of bourgeois individuals who on appearance looked like respectable members of their communities, but nevertheless enjoyed strange sexual fantasies and fantasized about apparently unusual sexual encounters and desires. His fantasy eclair book depicted a seemingly highly functioning modern world, peopled by individuals of responsibility, economic responsibility and of moral worth, who at the same time concealed uncivilized and regressive sexual identities within. The ambivalence of Krafft Ebing's book was encapsulated in his Latin. It was the respectful language of scientific taxonomy and classification, a sign of education and civilization. But it was also an obscene language of debauchery and sexual perversion. Krafft Ebing had invited the public to send him their autobiographies of their sex lives, which he included in subsequent editions of the Psychopathia Sexualis. Not infrequently, these new case studies actually criticised Krafft Ebing's theories, causing the doctor to develop growing sympathies with the so-called perverts criminalised by the law. In one case study, one of the longest, the subject, a man, a senior official at a factory, a university graduate, he describes himself as, he presents himself as highly cultured and refined, he longs to kiss his soldier lover, who is posted at a garrison in Hungary, as Krafft Ebing's Latin relates. This man's kisses sound just like those of Dido in the Aeneid. And whether this is a direct allusion or not to Virgil's poem, the man comes to look like an ancient female heroine waiting on the shores like Ariadne or Penelope for the return of her lover. This individual embodies this fin de siècle moment when Krafft Ebing was writing. He is both cultured and debauched, socially respectable and sexually perverted, both eloquent and obscene. The Latin purports to be a verbatim representation of the man's abnormal sexual desires, yet also reflects the man's more romantic view of his relationship with the soldier. Here Krafft Ebing reports the technical truth of sexual deviancy, whilst at the same time injecting pathos into the man's story. The Latin language signifies obscene behaviour, as well as a moment comparable to a scene from Western civilization's most admired poetry. Just as the man looks outwardly respectable, as well as sexually abnormal, both healthy and sick, so the Latin reflects such an ambivalence in Krafft Ebing's own thinking, as he himself became more and more sympathetic to the perverts he tried to treat, to the extent that by the end of his life, he supported the campaign in Germany for the decriminalisation of same-sex practices. Indeed, the lines between the civilised and the uncivilised, the normal and the abnormal, seemed especially hard to draw in the fin de siècle. Rather than an aura of scientific professionalism and authority then, Krafft Ebing's Latin came to reflect, mirror even, such a sense, such an atmosphere of uncertainty. Not unsurprisingly then, Krafft Ebing's attempt to construct a technical language in Latin for sexology did not catch on in the scientific community. Indeed, as we've seen, how to use ancient Rome's sexual vocabulary with authority was already a problem back in ancient Rome with Catullus. Neither Forberg nor Beccadelli appear in the indexes to the standard edition of Freud. Indeed, it was crucial for the development of psychoanalysis that Freud turned away from Roman historiography to ancient Greek myth. As I've already said, Krafft Ebing's book comprised autobiographical sexual narratives from his correspondence, and the Latin language was used as an attempt to deliver an accurate and literal account of those sexual lives. Krafft Ebing's investment in delivering historically truthful and literal narratives reflected the classical scholarship in the 19th century on ancient Rome, which sought to objectively and professionally present what they perceived to be ancient Rome's sexual perversion and decadence. A scholarly tradition, as we've seen, which began with Forberg's essay at the beginning of the 19th century. But it was precisely this idea that one could rely on the patient's autobiography, that the patient knew their own sexual history, which troubled Freud so much. Indeed, when Freud began analysing his patients for hysteria, he too became interested in his patients' pasts. But the idea that a literal and autobiographical narrative, a truthful narrative, could provide the explanation for his patient's symptoms seemed unhelpful to the budding psychoanalyst. In a now famous footnote in his three essays on sexuality published in 1905, he wrote that sexologists have published a number of autobiographical narratives, These reports naturally suffer from the fact that they omit the prehistoric period of the writer's sexual lives, which is veiled by infantile amnesia, which can only be filled in by psychoanalysis in the case of an individual who's developed a neurosis. When Freud listened to his patients' stories about their past as they lay on the couch downstairs, he didn't think that their stories were entirely true. The tales the patients told about their lives were not literal, but symbolic representations, which covered up a deeper, unconscious, repressed prehistory, as Freud puts it here, veiled by infantile amnesia, an earlier period in which the child played out the Oedipus myth in their heads. The discourses of history and autobiography, then, could only go so far, precisely because the origins of our sexuality lay in childhood fantasies, in myths we spun in our minds, which we can barely remember as adults, but which continue to influence how we interact with those we love and hate today. Freudian psychoanalysis, then, with its turn to Greek myth, was also a turning away from 19th century sexology's preoccupation with ancient Rome. The classical Latin terms I've been exploring tonight were indeed in the process of becoming the terms by which sexual identity was being described in the 19th century. But Freud's intervention ensured that the 20th century would have to wrestle with a very different myth instead. Thank you. Probably quite a lot to take in, yeah.
In terms of Freud and his fascination for sexuality in the antiquity, there's the language, but there's also all the mythology of all the different characters in Roman mythology who always run after each other, and whether it's to. And I was wondering, what did you? I thought you might talk also about this as well, the actual theme of in the mythology of sex in. Whether it has interested him or not.
Yeah, so he doesn't really, what's quite interesting about Freud in all his writings, he doesn't really do a kind of reading of Greek myths very often, you know, so he performs analysis of literature, but he never performs an extended sort of literary criticism or psychoanalytic literary criticism of a particular Greek myth, you know, so he's actually often more interested in kind of modern retellings of Greek myth in poetry by Schiller, or he's most famously interested in a short story or a novella called Grediva, which is precisely about a German archaeologist who's digging up antiquities, those sorts of antiquities in Pompeii. So he's interested in a kind of figure like him digging up, you know, the ancient world and stuff. So Freud himself doesn't in any extended way write about Greek mythology itself. That happens after Freud, basically. So people start psychoanalyzing Greek mythology or performing Freudian readings on Greek mythology after Freud, and that's a practice that literary scholars partake in well into the end of the latter parts of the 20th century, basically. So and the particular stance that they take is the idea that, how can I put this? What was interesting about, when Freud read literature, what was interesting to Freud was how he could extract the author's neuroses, desires, Oedipal complex going on by looking at the author's poem. Okay, so that's what Freud did with literature when he read literature and wrote about literature and publicly lectured about literature. So he wrote about Hamlet and other plays, And he said that, you know, from this play, you can see what's going on in Shakespeare's psychology. So psychoanalysis is a way of understanding an author's psychology. And that mode of reading a poem, a play, or a novel, in order to understand the repressed unconscious of the writer, that becomes a very prominent part of literary criticism from the 1930s, you know, really into the 1960s, even 1970s. So Freud himself doesn't engage and read Greek myths themselves. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Okay. Because I was wondering if there would be the obsession about some of the myth in antiquity, whether it would help how to deal with their own sexuality.
Yes.
And whether you had...
Yeah, exactly. So in the interpretation of dreams, when he introduces the Oedipus complex for the first time to the public in 1900, when the book finally comes out, he's basically arguing that Sophocles, who wrote the play Oedipus the King, the original Greek play, he's partly arguing that Sophocles himself suffers an Oedipus complex. Okay, so, and maybe to develop on what you were also asking, there's a big question as to, you know, why on earth would he choose Oedipus and then generalise this across all of humanity? So he says famously in Interpretation of Dreams, you know, we're moved by this play precisely because we're seeing ourselves on stage, you know? And what he said wouldn't have been quite so odd in the context he was writing at the end of the 19th century, precisely because Oedipus was a real hero in German philosophical thought. So there's a long series of German philosophers, people like Schelling, Hegel, and others, who talk about Oedipus as being a hero who's fighting against a fate that is ordained by the gods, but he can't do anything about it. And so he's practicing his freedom in fighting against necessity, and that somehow reflects the human condition. And so it's his awful fate for him to kill his father and marry his mother, but that's just a symbol for this kind of big conflict between human will and the human sense of wanting to do what you want, human freedom, and fate and necessity you're fighting against. So in German philosophy, before Freud, Oedipus was already this kind of universal figure of man who's trying to do the best he can. He's the king of Thebes. He's trying to solve this plague that's affecting Thebes, but the plague has been sent down by the gods because Oedipus himself has previously killed his father unbeknownst to him and married his mother unbeknownst to him, you know. So, but all that Freud does is he kind of literalizes it. He says that, yeah, we are all like Oedipus, not just because we're fighting against our fate, which is the Oedipus complex, but also because we literally fantasize about the mother's breast and the murder of the father. So he just takes the interpretation of Oedipus just one step further than a whole 100 years of 19th century authors have done. So that's why it might sound slightly crazy right now, or it might not, depending on your viewpoint, but in the 19th century, it wasn't unproblematic, but it was not, you know, it had definitely had an intellectual context out of which it emerged. Yeah, sure.
That is really interesting about language and the sort of the way in which the kind of erotic graphic Latin verse was used in different ways. Is there any evidence of any sort of similar strand in ancient Greek of that sort of erotic writing and use of language?
Yes, so the Greek stuff has a very sort of different sort of history, precisely because Greek never has, Greek doesn't have the same sort of history as Latin did. So Greek was not a language that was taught in Europe. Greek was taught during the Renaissance partly to a kind of very narrow range of society. And then it kind of fell out, and Greek again got taught in the end of the 19th century, through end of the 18th century through the 19th century. So Greek was always this really recherché sort of subject that only the best boys and occasional girls could get to learn. Whereas on the other hand, Latin was a far more accessible language across the middle classes in the 19th, 18th century. Also, Latin was a lingua franca, you know, for almost 1,000 years. So the number of people who could read Latin was a lot wider. So the sort of people who engaged with Greek erotics were generally people who were far more aristocratic, basically, because far fewer people got the chance to learn Greek. And so the most common reception of ancient Greek literature, erotically, would have been the kind of configuration of ancient Greek love in a modern homosexual context in the 18th and 19th century. So you had kind of German, British, Italian, French homosexuals in the 18th and 19th century exchanging letters in written in ancient Greek, you know, quoting bits of Plato and other Greek authors, expressing their desires for each other. And that writing was often, either it was private or it was published in a kind of semi-private fashion. So at the end of the 19th century, you had lots of writers actually writing in response to Krafft Ebing. So there was a very famous British classicist, and actually he was one of the most famous British writers. So if I was giving this lecture right now, 100 years ago, and I said the name John Addington Symonds to you, it'd be like saying Zadie Smith. He was one of Britain's most famous living writers at the time, and he lived a double life. You know, he was a famous celebrity. He wrote an extremely famous history of the Renaissance. He wrote well-known poetry. But he lived his double life because he was having an affair with a Venetian gondolier. Okay? He wrote a letter to Krafft Ebing. And Krafft Ebing included one of his letters, John Addington Symonds' letters, in this 12th edition of his book. And Symonds wrote in this letter, "I can't agree with your theories of perversion because what I feel is noble. It feels like it comes from ancient Greece and so on." Okay, so a lot of the stuff that emerged about Greek love in the Victorians in the 19th century was a kind of a reaction to this kind of discourse about debauchery and sexual perversion that was associated with Roman texts. So Greek love was often seen as something very noble. It was associated with Oxford and Cambridge, Göttingen and the University in Berlin and stuff like that. Wealthy young men who were kind of participating in philosophy at the same time as loving each other, you know? So it was this kind of highly idealized sort of reaction to this kind of Roman smut that was circulating, basically. So Greek, the reception of Greek erotics had a very different, but it was in reaction to this kind of Roman reception. So, you know, early pornography written in the 17th century was always written in Latin because lots and lots of people could read Latin. So we don't have pornography ever written in ancient Greek, for instance. You know. So lots of 17th century French authored pornographic novels were written in what we call Neo-Latin or modern Latin. So Greek had this altogether more kind of recherché, you know, this is not to do with us sort of thing. We're in a university doing our own thing. Yes.
Also a language question, although perhaps slightly tangential. The time when sexology is developing is also a period when there's a lot of philological study of Indo-European languages. And to what degree would study of Sanskrit and some of the ancient Sanskrit texts, erotic,
that's
play into the development of the antique, the association between the antique and the literary?
Okay, so I'll just take you back to this slide. So this slide actually came from a book which was talking, this slide comes from a book that was published in the 1780s. And what's interesting about this period, when these archaeologists were excavating Pompeii and Herculaneum, they were coming up with these kind of really odd-looking objects, and classical scholars still don't know today what they mean. People say they're fertility stuff, and they label them as fertility stuff, and nobody else knows what to say about them, okay? So that, the one on the top left, that's a door knocker, okay? So that would have appeared on someone's front door, okay? So, you know, and that would have been a bell, that bottom left from there, okay? So it was kind of weird because Rome was associated with A, the Renaissance, and B, the Roman Catholic Church. And then suddenly in the middle of the 18th century, people started to see how Romans really lived. And they were like, well, there's all this everywhere. This is not the image of the Romans that we've been receiving for the last 700 years since the fall of Rome. Okay. And what was also interesting about this time in the 1780s, it coincided with the British taking a firmer colonial grip on India. And that then also coincided with the discovery that Sanskrit was cognate with Greek and Latin. Okay, and so the guy who published this book also published lots of images not dissimilar images of sculpture from India with erect phalluses as well, you know. And so what's interesting is in the 19th century, you get this kind of, this kind of drops out of interest, this kind of closeness between Greece, Rome, and the East. So in the 18th century, before hieroglyphs were deciphered in Egypt, people, you know, really did have this kind of very cosmopolitan view or multicultural view of the Mediterranean, you know. That kind of drops out with with linguistics in the 19th century, right? But what was interesting about Freud is that he was very interested in this history, okay? And so this, you know, you can see downstairs, I don't know if they're on display, the phallic objects, or are they?
They're kind of buried quite deep in some
okay,
the
there
cases,
you go, so okay.
So not that's deliberately, yeah, that's just where Freud
okay,
them.
Yeah, there you go, exactly. So
we did have, in the Freudian era,
exactly,
we
yeah,
had lots of up here on
exactly. So Freud collected lots of these phallic objects from Japan, India, all across the world, and he was very interested in this idea that these phallic objects came from everywhere, and these 18th century guys were arguing that, and they were very sort of, they were Enlightenment figures, so they were very anti-Christian. They were arguing that before monotheistic religions, and then before polytheism, Greek and Roman paganism, there was an or original religion, which was the worship of nature. Okay? And it was this kind of enlightened religion, which was the worship of natural processes, the worship of how nature works. And the earliest form of man's religion, they argued, these Enlightenment philosophers, was that they visualized this worship of nature in the representation of organs of reproduction. Okay? And this original phallic worship, or worship of nature, was practiced everywhere across the world. It was all original man was the same, basically. There were no different races. We all developed in the same way. That's the Enlightenment sort of way of constructing history, but a religious history, okay? And Freud takes this on entirely. You know, he says that when we all desire the mother, the mother's breast, we're all yearning for a mother that he calls her the phallic mother, the mother who has all the body parts all in one. She's both a man and a woman. She's full, she's plentiful. She's this, like, this natural object, this natural phallic worship stuff going on. So the history of the child begins with this kind of worship of the mother, just like the history of civilization begins with the worship of the mother. So Freud is a Jew writing at a time when Aryans and Semites are being, you know, distinguished, you know, linguistically and racially. But Freud is taking a very different line on things. And so he's writing a very 18th century Enlightenment history and saying, well, all children worshipped this original fertility figure, you know. And all the Indian stuff, that's where that, you know, he was very interested in kind of ancient Indian representations of phallic worship, just as they appeared in Greece and Rome as well. So the understanding of Indian antiquity is definitely important for Freud, yeah. Does that answer the question?
Yes.
Okay.
Any questions?
I will just thank you very much. It's really fascinating. As you said, there are huge amounts to sort of unpick and think about.
Yes.
And presumably a lot more to discover here as well. But so it's quite appropriate thinking about European culture tonight.
Yeah.
Tomorrow. And not quite sure what Nigel Farage would say of this. But anyway, thank you so much. Yeah. Really fascinating talk, and looking forward to your kind of three-part series later in the year. So thank you very much.